The job of investigative journalists is to nail the bad guys. Investigative journalists probe, scrutinize, pore over documents, ask tough questions, shine lights under rocks to see what has been hidden there, and of course, follow the money. The movies make it out to be the most glamorous job in the media world, but it's actually one of the toughest, with long hours, wild goose chases, and risks. Because the bad guys will do everything in their power to prevent being nailed, including shooting the messenger. Welcome to the third episode of Stolen, the podcast that takes a behind-the-scenes look at the ongoing story of state capture. In this episode, we speak to the Sunday Times' deputy editor, Stembiso Msomi, and the newspaper's senior investigative journalist, Zilikazi wa Africa, about the risks journalists face in their efforts to expose the corrupt. Zilikazi, you've said you have received more death threats than birthday presents. Did you understand the dangers involved when you decided to become an investigative journalist?
Yeah, I kind of understood, because the day when I decided to be an investigative journalist, I was with my grandfather. So I said to him, I said, look, Grandpa, I really know I love journalism, but I want to do a different kind of journalism. And he said, what is that? I said, I want to do investigative journalism. So he said to me, I'll ask you one question. If you can answer that question correctly, then I'll know you'll become an investigative journalist. He says to me, there's a lion charging. You've got a gun and a knife. Which weapon are you going to use to defend yourself? And that's a very, very tricky question. Then I thought about it and I said to him, I think I'll use the knife. And he said, there you go. You are a good investigative journalist. Don't use the gun. Use the knife.
Why?
Yeah. Because a gun is, it's like a shortcut. You know, it will shoot a lion when it's 100 meters away. But with the knife, you have to fight with it physically and defeat it to win the fight. Then it shows bravery.
Okay. In a sense, you haven't stopped fighting the lion.
No.
And can you tell us about the recent death threats that you received in relation to the dodgy Eskom tender story that you wrote about?
You see, at the time when we got a tip-off, we didn't have as much information as we've got now. But now, we kind of know who were the people behind it, because they started going around showing people videos of them following me around, and most of the time asking other people to help them identify the people I was meeting, and all to find that the people on those videos had nothing to do with Eskom. I met them on a different, complete different stories. So it was that kind of a project where people got some people to follow me around to see who I'm meeting, so they can identify the sources, so they can intimidate them, harass them, or God knows what else they can do. So it happened that I got a tip off from someone who was hired to do the job, but he said after he got a briefing that he must do something bad to me, and then he went home, he googled, and then he realized what sort of person I am and what I have done, and he decided he's not going to do what the bad guys ask him to do.
But so he had a change of heart because he had seen reputation.
Yes. Yeah. So he came forward and told us about it.
And when you heard that one of your journalists had received death threats, how does the newspaper deal with that?
It's a difficult situation. It always depends on the circumstances, because there have been instances where you hear this kind of information and you follow it up and it's just a rumor, it's not happening, and other instances where you find that actually there's something going on here. So we try now and again to do security assessment for journalists that we work with, but I think our greatest weapon is to expose it. Every time it happens, we need to talk about it. We've had one instance, for instance, I think last week, where one of our colleagues had his car broken into. We're still investigating that to see if it's not linked to the kind of investigations that he has been doing. The silly thing he did was to go and park next to one of the companies that he has been investigating. So we don't know whether those guys thought, well, there he is, and then they decided they break into his car, take his laptop and see what is in there.
And I mean, besides those sorts of things, their phones have been hacked, and quite recently, in relation to the story where you had been arrested, which was the timing of your arrest was very curious, but it emerged that your phone has been hacked and tapped. So it's not only coming from, and that was for the person responsible was a former, or was a policeman at the time. Mm. So it's not only from kind of, you know, organized criminals, it's also from other elements.
You see, the problem now, these guys, they've gang up like together, like where they've went around shopping for grabbers, where they'll just covertly put people's number, because you know a grabber can put as many numbers as he can. Like we understand, or we've been told, that a group of businessmen, they put their money together and went to buy, I think, 3 or 4 grabbers, so they can use one to spy on journalists, and secondly to spy on their business rival, to see what deals they're negotiating and how they're coming around with it. So, but again, how do you prove the grabber came into this country illegal? How do you prove that there is a number of illegal grabbers in this country and they're being used against you? It's very difficult. Again, you ask yourself, is our intelligence aware of those illegal grabbers? If they are aware, what are they doing about it? Like yesterday, as I was driving to work, I was told that my phone is bugged again, with an instruction from one minister who's thinking like I'm up to get it. So it's one of those things, like it happens every day. So the best way is every day of your life, behave as your phone is bugged. Mm-hmm. Say little and try other avenues to discuss things that are very sensitive.
I think it's been the attitude generally in journalism and even in politics maybe, but in journalism mostly, to just assume that everyone is bugged. I know the guys who work for intelligence will say, there are just too many of you for us to be listening to all of you all the time. But it's safer to just move from the basis that there is someone out there listening. Part of the problem in this country, I think, is that you have a lot of freelance, rogue, former intelligence officers, some of them in the police, some of them working on their own now as individuals. And they see opportunities of making money by trying to gather as much information as possible. And journalists become targets because we are out there talking to people all the time. So if they know that Mzee is an investigative journalist, they think if they follow Mzee around and they sell that information to politicians, that look, is coming after you for 1, 2, 3, then that politician will be able to pay them for whatever information they are selling him.
With the Gupta emails and the leaks, which go all the way to the top and implicate very powerful people, how do you protect your sources in this environment?
See, that's a noble and a good thing that every journalist should and must protect their sources. So with the Gupta emails, you know, there are a lot of information that is leading to certain individuals. So the best way is to find a platform on softening those people and ask them to give you more details. Like, for example, you might see an email going maybe to Atul or Nazim, say, let's meet at 3 o'clock at the family resident. So you go to that person and say, did you go to that meeting? What was discussed? Who else was there? What were their contributions to the meeting and stuff like that? But then you need to build that trust with the source and make sure that you're going to protect the source by all means, because they're going to come with tons of bricks attacking you and the source.
When you got the most recent death threats, you decided to editorially become the story. Did you report it to the authorities?
No, we didn't, but we reported to our lawyer, who filed an affidavit. He's keeping that affidavit with him, so should anything happen, it's us there, it's recorded. Because again, you go to the police, you don't even know whose ass is involved. You might be going to the lion's den, because some of the people who might go to might be part of this whole shenanigan. Like, there's a lot of rogue police out there. I mean, the minister of police read about my story. He knows me very well. We've been friends for years. He never even called me and asked me, "Hey, my friend, what's happening? Do you need some protection or anything like that?" He's never done so.
And sometimes you want to keep the state away from you, because sometimes by just saying, "I've got this problem," you're giving them a legal cover for them to do any covert operation that involves you, that is supposedly aimed at protecting you, but the intention is to find out who your sources are.
Yeah, most definitely.
So the authorities are not very helpful.
No.
Yes, sir, you have to assess, but in most instances, if you can stay away, the better.
So how should journalists deal with these threats?
My take is that every time we discover or every time a threat is made, go public with it. It's the best form of protection, because whatever happens to the journalist after that, everyone knows what's going on. So it may scare those people who are making the threat away from acting. In a way, I would say we are still a bit lucky as a country that in most instances, the intention is just to intimidate. The intention is to make the journalists feel that I can't do these stories. And so it is always better for us to just, once we hear about it, put it out there, and then maybe they will back off. But then take precautions, security precautions. Make sure that on the phone, you are not reckless in terms of the information that you share on the phone. And also, your own security. You just become more aware of what you're doing and how you go about doing things.
I also think that we as journalists must not be, if someone threatens you, it should be a motivation for you to go deeper and harder on them.
And yes.
So that they'll know next time they won't repeat the same thing, because you will have taught them a lesson or two.
The threats, in a way, are validation that you're doing your job, mm-hmm. and you're getting close to the truth.
Most definitely.
If you're being targeted, it means you're making the people who fear exposure uncomfortable.
That's why I always say to people like my friends, say like, when the death threat become fewer, I get worried that I'm not doing the job.
No, my worry is, well, I mean, death threats are dangerous, and it's something that you cannot take lightly. But my worry is usually when petty tricks are employed.
Yes, that's
like when Mzi was doing a story about Dina Pule, for instance, how somehow there was an attempt to create an alternative story about what was going on. That for me is even more problematic, because generally it then creates the environment for those kinds of attacks to happen, and the perception will have been created that this journalist is doing something wrong. And I think that's one thing that we really struggle with. How do we immediately react to that kind of counter information?
And we're seeing this, exactly what you're talking about, getting stronger and bigger. Fake news, anonymous campaigns being waged, trying to undermine journalists and attack their integrity. For example, Twitter bots and cyber trolls spreading malicious rumors about journalists. We saw the WMC leaks website that was launched, which published defamatory stories about Peter Bruce. Mm. So how should journalists respond to that sort of attack?
I believe as long as you know your integrity is not questionable, no matter what they say, no matter if they say you have done it, you know you have never done that, you are safe. Because at the end of the day, it might take months, weeks, but the truth will set you free. Same thing with the Dina Pule thing. People said, I've written a lot of things about me, but at the end of the day, months down the line, the truth came out and people realized, oh, this was how these guys were playing this thing, because they were just trying to just character assassinate you, you know, all of that.
Yeah, but what I think has been a weakness generally, not with us as a newspaper, but with the media as a whole, I think we take too much time to respond. and it's easier for a fake news story to gain currency because we are not responding to what is happening. So immediately we know that the story about Peter Bruce is propaganda. We need to be out there. We need to be speaking out to say, actually, these are the facts. And it needs to be a collective effort. So it cannot just be the journalist who's involved alone or the publication they work for. It needs to be the whole media community. Because we've seen, for instance, there was another one about one of our colleagues at Sowetan, Moiponi. And you look at this story. Everything is wrong, including the publication that she works for. It's wrong information. But I think we take too long to say, actually, these are the facts, and this is what she does, and this is her relationship to this person or that person. So I think if we were to react much faster, it will help.
There's a saying about the lie gets halfway around the world before the truth has the time to get its pants on.
Yeah.
So it's important to respond as quickly as possible.
Yes.
But in this world of fake news, the fake news has a way of just dominating.
Unfortunately, yeah.
That's why people always say good news is bad news. Because, you see, the good news travel fast like Ferrari. And the good news is like a donkey, just slowly. By the time you get there, all the damage, all the thing, it's like. But at the end of the day, your integrity, you must know where you stand. No matter what mud they throw at you, you know where you are clean.
You've been arrested, you've had death threats, your character has been sort of questioned. Do you sometimes want to give it up and just focus on the safer world of music where you have been very successful?
For me, music is like my bar. I go there after a long, hard day. I go to the studio and make music, write songs, so to unwind and all of that. For me, journalism is a calling. It's not a profession. So I'll die with my boots on.
Yeah. Without investigative journalists, where would we be in this Gupta email story?
I think we'll still be in that realm we were in around 2010, where it was just only rumors that there is this influence by this family, and everyone thought, no, it's just, well, initially people were saying this is an anti-Indian sentiment. You're targeting these guys because they are foreigners, and yet there are many other people around, politicians in the country, who've been doing those things. So the emails are showing us that actually no one has ever done what the Guptas are doing. Yes, people have had relationships with politicians as they do around the world, and yes, people have broken rules, but the Guptas have gone much deeper than that. They've actually taken over the state. They are running the president.
South Africa has a proud history of excellent investigative journalism, from Drum magazine revealing the brutal prison and farm labor conditions of the 50s, to the expose of death squads during apartheid, to Nkandlagate, and now the Gupta emails. Can you give us some insight into the power of investigative journalism to expose corruption and hold people account?
I mean, yeah, like you said, we've got, I think what really encouraged me to do investigative journalism is that by looking at what the doyens of investigative journalism have done during those days, you know, what they went through, the challenges. So when you look at Henry Nxumalo, you look at what he has done, you know, it really gave me more special, because I think for me, really what really, my mom is Nxumalo, so I thought like I'm doing what my uncle used to do, you know. So like carrying on the legacy and all of that. But We have done a lot of good stories in South Africa, although some of them were not told rightly, so because of fear of the unknown. But I think when the future generation of investigative journalism look at what we have done, like let look from 1994 until today, they will say these guys really worked their asses off.
I think this is a culture we should not lose. I sometimes worry about journalism schools now, whether they do remind journalists who are coming into the system that there is a culture that has gone on for close to 100 years in this country of investigative journalism, and that it is an integral part of our democracy. That post-1994, actually, at a time when most people thought everything was fine and we just moving on with our lives, it was journalists who came up with investigations like the arms deal to show us that what was wrong in the country. Today, everyone has accepted that there is state capture. It is partly because of the kind of work that journalists have been doing over the years. So it is a culture that should never stop, no matter who's in government. Everyone who comes into journalism, your job is to make sure that you bring to light that which is in the dark.
You've been listening to Stolen, the podcast taking you behind the scenes of our coverage of the revealed Gupta emails and state capture. This production is brought to you by Multimedia Live in collaboration with Sunday Times and The Times, and our anchor is Jonathan Anser. We'd like to thank the editors Andrew Trench, Stambisa Masomi, and the journalists Graham Hoskin, Sabelo Skitty, Genevieve Quintal, Kyle Cowan, and Mzilikazi Wa Africa. I'm your producer, Scott Peter Smith. Thanks for listening.